We just before we had to quit real quick or take a break for an update. Philip read a story from this book, and then we had to quick do and go on to the market report. And I know that you wanted to just say a couple more things.
Yeah, first of all, to remind people, the name of the book, In Fond Remembrance of Me, a memoir of myth and uncommon friendship in the Arctic, written by Howard Norman. It's a memoir. In Fond Remembrance of Me actually is a as a reference to the title of a packet of writing that was sent to Howard Norman from Helen Tanizaki, his friend, after she died in Japan. Mm. And the wonderful thing about this book is he never refers to anything that's in that packet. Mm. It's very personal writings and things about her life that she wanted him always to remember her. But this memoir is his attempt to remember her through their interactions that last year of her life and his first year as a budding translator. The other thing that I love about this book is that as it goes along and you see the relationship develop between Howard Norman and Helen Tanizaki, this new translator learning a lot of things from this very established translator, but also the relationship with Mark Nunkok, the storyteller, and then every chapter or two, we get another Noah story, and you which are in fact the stories that both he and Helen are translating while they're developing their relationship. You begin to see the connections between the stories that they're translating and their relationship, and especially the relationship with the storyteller. I mean, Howard seems very much like Noah to Mark Nunkok, who can't stand him. You know, he doesn't know anything about Inuit culture. Right. He seems completely incompetent and an example of that kind of Western arrogance of coming in and kind of, you know, trying to do something when you really aren't prepared, whereas Helen knows the culture deeply and well, and he loves Helen. And a lot of this is done without Howard Norman having to say anything. One of the things that's beautiful about this book is that you begin to make the connections yourself between the stories of the storyteller and Howard Norman's own stories of him and Helen as this book develops. And it's one of the most beautiful and engaging and narratively exciting, though nothing really happens, books that I've ever read. This is why sometimes you really love a book, you kiss the cover just to let it know that it's a great book. And this is one of those cover kissing books. You know?
So wait, I have a question. So there, so interspersed with the translated stories
are just tales of what it was like living up north with Helen and his also his relationship with Mark Nunkok and his family.
Yes. Yeah. So it's one of those books that also gives you some appreciation of the difficulties of trying to go and understand another culture.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Right. Very good. Well, Tanya.
Well, I think I'll do the big one here.
It's the biggest book you got in your pile.
Yeah. It's called 7 Types of Ambiguity by Elliot Perlman, and it is a novel. But whenever I speak to writers about it, because I know a few, they say, oh, 7 Types of Ambiguity, sure. We've read that. Mm-hmm. We know all about that. And I say, oh, really? I thought it was a new, it's a new novel. It just came out. They say, novel? What in the world are you talking about? Yeah. There is a book called 7 Types of Ambiguity, mm-hmm. by Empson. William Empson.
Yeah. I think it's William Empson, yeah.
And it is not a book I would ever in a million years have any interest in reading. It's about...
Oh, it's a wonderful book.
Oh, Phil.
No, I'm not kidding. It's a wonderful book. It is.
It may be.
It was an important book for me when I was young. He talks with great, great detail about, 7 types of ambiguity and how you establish that and how you can...
Yes. It's a book for writers.
It's an
instructional sort of a... I've looked at it now, of course, because of this.
I should actually go back and read it again.
You should go back and read it again. About how there are these 7 types of ambiguity in storytelling, in writing.
And poetry.
And in poetry, yes. And how and what they are and how you implement them and why they're important and et cetera, et cetera. Well, he's stolen the title here, but he's credited him. The main character, there's not one protagonist. It's a very complicated book, very layered. One of the main characters in the book is obsessed with that book, 7 Types of Ambiguity by Empson, so much so that he's named his dog Empson after the author, right? Mm-hmm. And the brilliant thing about this book is that whatever it is that Empson does in his book, which I haven't read, with words, like he talks, you know, ambiguity with words. I mean, that's what writing is in poetry. And, you know, you use words and you want to, you know, have this ambiguity there. Elliot Perlman shows us that that is also true of human relationships, that there are these seven different types of ambiguity in our relationships with one another, whether it's a mother and a daughter relationship, two best friends, mm-hmm. lovers, strangers, enemies, whatever your relationship is to our relationship, David, mm-hmm. you and I have a very different concept, notion of what our relationship mm-hmm. is. Mm-hmm. Each of us has, each of us, none of us can know, none of us are experiencing the same relationship with mm-hmm. the other person that we're experiencing it with. And this book does that so well. It demonstrates that. You really do. Every chapter is from a different person's perspective. There are seven main characters in the book. And each of them is telling you a story that you're getting pieces of, but you can't see what the reality mm-hmm. of the situation is until you've completed it. Mm-hmm. Because everybody has a different idea of what the situation is, what the relationships are, what exactly is going on. And it's a really clever little way to do that. And it begins with, and maybe there's a word for this or a phrase for this that writers use, I don't know. But when the protagonist speaks to you as if you are part of the story, is there like a
second person?
No, not
like
second person. But
yes, you're doing that, or what's it, like a direct address?
It's like a direct address, mm-hmm. but it's not a direct address. It's more complicated than mm-hmm. that. It's not a direct address to the reader, like you are the reader and you are reading the story. Mm-hmm. It says you, and you begin to see that what he means is that you are one of the characters in this story. Huh. So you're feeling like the object. Well,
that's a little bit like second person.
It's a little bit like second. And there's a kidnap. It's a heavy book. I almost think people should read it just because of the strategy that mm-hmm. Perlman uses to see this. And there's all kinds of little things going on. There's a kidnapping at the beginning. And you think, what in the world
is... At the beginning.
At the very beginning.
You can refer to my earlier... There's a footnote here. Refer to my earlier comments.
There's a kidnapping at the beginning, and what you find is that this gentleman has kidnapped his therapist.
Mm.
Yeah.
That's going to cost a lot of money.
Yeah. The therapist... I'm just going to give you a little setup here. The therapist is, there are lots of affairs going on in this book. And the therapist is having an affair with a prostitute whom his client, the protagonist, is also having an affair with. But they don't know that. Nobody knows anything about anybody in this book. But they all think...
They do.
That they do.
That's life.
How like life.
Yeah, how like life. That's the thing about it, is that it's so like life. Plus, there are these wonderful dialogues and a lot of politics in it. And every character in it, you know someone. It's one of those books where each of these people, we all know someone who is like each of these people.
Yeah.
And it's just a masterful little...
It seems to me, hasn't this book gotten a lot of favorable comment and good reviews? This is a big,
It has made a splash, really.
Not a gigantic one.
Because I was going to say, I didn't know. I wasn't aware of it.
Is he Australian?
He's Australian.
So. Yeah.
I know we actually, I believe that we got a copy of that book in some time back, mm-hmm. and I sat down and I started reading it.
Right.
And it sucked me in right away,
really
for me is a good mm-hmm. sign. I mean, if I just start reading it and then I have to say, okay, I can't keep reading this now. I got other stuff to
right.
do.
That's a good sign. Yeah. And it's very, very plot heavy, big, big story here. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the writing is very good as well, but really it's the plot that is thick and it's real dense and but real accessible too.
Yeah. Okay. Seven Types of Ambiguity is the title of the book. Oh, and who's the author?
Elliot Perlman.
All right.
Not William Empson. If you pick that up and begin to read it, you may think I'm crazy. Although
that's
Philip,
a good book too. Very good.
Well, if you enjoy that,
if you're
you might,
a writer, yeah,
you're a writer.
And
right.
it's one of the I don't really care for the kind of literary criticism that's too convoluted. But Empson's
but
book is very, very well written and clear.
Yeah. We have a caller here. I tell you what, why don't we bring him into the conversation? Someone listening in Kankakee. Let's talk with them right here on our line number 4. Hello.
Perhaps an important book and one which your listener would wish to have read and discussed among the current new books is Jeffrey D. Sachs, The End of Poverty, Economic Possibilities for Our Time. The author is J-E-F-F-R-E-Y Sachs, S-A-C-H-S, ISBN 1-594-200-459, published by Penguin Press. The subject is global development to eliminate extreme poverty, and the primary message is that extreme poverty can be eliminated, the author suggests, if the rich countries would invest 0.7% of their gross national product to direct financial assistance to poor countries. Whether the author's program would accomplish that, which he says it would or not, this listener is in no position to evaluate, but he's all for looking into the matter. The author, Jeffrey Sachs, is director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University, and might prove to be a productive guest if he were to become a Focus 580 guest. Have you discussed Sachs? Do you know?
No, we haven't.
It's a big bestseller, though.
And it sounds like the kind of thing that we would be likely to do. I will have to check. It's possible that we received a copy of the book. I don't know. I guess one question would be when was it published?
It's 2005. Brand new book just came to my attention. About a week or so back, and it was in a Kankakee Daily Journal brief on the faith page a couple of weeks ago. But it does show a 2005 copyright date. It's got a foreword by the musician Bono, which was dated 2004. Hmm. It's brand new piece of work.
All right. Well, we will certainly look into it.
Appreciate you doing that.
And see if we can do that. It looks like it came out in March. So I would think that the author might very well likely still be doing interviews about the book. We'll see if we can do that.
Appreciate it.
Thank you for the suggestion.
You should also try to get a hold of that guy who wrote the book that's also on the bestseller list, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, if you haven't done it already.
Yeah.
That's an amazing book.
That's really interesting. I haven't read the whole thing, but I've just looked at it.
My son is reading it right now, and he's just amazed by it. Okay. I want to read it, too.
Have you heard of this Freakonomics?
Yeah, it seems...
People are scooping it up.
Yeah, I know, but I saw the guy do an interview, and he seemed not that intelligent to me. It's one of those things where you make a broad statement for provocative reasons, and then everybody goes out and buys your book. I wasn't impressed.
Okay, let's talk with somebody else here in Urbana, line 1. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I'd like to bring the conversation around to mystery books. I wonder if the Pages for All Ages person is familiar with the author Adora Sale, S-A-L-E. She has a pseudonym. She writes as Carolyn Rowe.
Yes, now that name I recognize.
Okay.
I recognize Carolyn Rowe.
Right, and
I've read
many of her medieval mysteries. Mm-hmm. But I'd never heard of Medora Sale, but...
I haven't either.
Well, that's too bad, because I was hoping that you might know what else she writes as Medora Sale.
No, but you know what? We can find out real quickly here. David's doing
it. You'll have to... I'm not sure I got the right spelling of her name.
S-A-L-E is the last name.
Uh-huh. And the first?
I'm going to.
Is it just kind of like it sounds?
Spelling on that, yes, just as it sounds.
M A D O R A?
M, like Mary, E D O R A.
Oh, M E. M A.
No, M E.
M E.
M E D O R A. Okay, Medora Sale. There, it does list a couple of titles that it looks like maybe they might be older books and that they're not in print anymore because, well, here's one that's called, the title is called A Shortcut to Santa Fe by Medora Sale, indeed. And it's a book that was published in 1994. So maybe that name it was maybe the things that you wrote under that name are older titles. And, you know, it's with books like this, things do go out of print.
Right.
Yeah, they sure do.
Yeah.
But you can always find used copies of things.
Mm-hmm.
It's not difficult to do. We can almost always find a used copy somewhere if you're interested.
Really? I can order that through Pages?
Yeah, if you – well, I don't know absolutely for sure, but if you call the bookstore, we have an out-of-print book search that we can do and find out. Yeah. And frequently people are selling them used. Mm-hmm. So we do order some used books. So if those are available at our distributor, then we would be able to get them for you.
It does here, and I'm looking on the – you should pardon the expression – the Amazon website. And
yes.
There are four titles – listed that they have, and that they have some used and new. There are some of their audio cassettes, but it does list just these four titles: Murder in Focus, Shortcut to Santa Fe, Murder on the Run, and Sleep of the Innocent. So,
yeah, if you call the store and give someone the author's name, we'll be able to find out. Yeah, if we can get them.
Thank you so much. And for other people who are mystery buffs, the Carolyn Rowe mysteries are just very well written and a great read. The protagonist is a 14th century Jewish physician who works with who is the physician to the bishop of his town, and also interacts in Spain with this very rich mixture of Christians and Muslims and Jews. So very interesting.
All right. Wow. Very good. Well, thank you. Well,
thank
we
you.
Have some other folks we will get to in a moment. The only thing we really want to do here is to check in on how we're doing with raising money this morning, because we did have that challenge. And I want to go to Pledge Central here. And Dave Teal, our program director of WLTV, I think should be standing by. Tell us, Dave, can you tell us how we're doing on this challenge we've talked about now a couple times?
I can indeed. We are at 13, 7 to go toward the challenge and an extra $200 from a couple in Urbana. And I think we can go well past that, actually. I don't think we need to stop at 20 by any means. So 244-9455 is the number to call right now. Get in on that challenge. Help us to reach that goal and also take advantage of the free book offer.
And maybe we'll talk about that one more time if people weren't listening earlier. When we do the shows here with Philip and Tanya, when we do it during Fund Drive, we're always looking for ways to encourage people to make a pledge. And here at the radio station, we receive from publishers a lot of books, very, very good books, more than we could possibly do on the show. And many of the authors appear on the program, and there are others that for one reason or another, we can't do. But we do save those books. Occasionally, we give them away to people who work at the radio station here and the TV station here. And they're like vultures. You should see it. We put the books out and they descend upon them. But when we come around to time when we're raising money, we set aside a number of good books, fiction and nonfiction, as a way of encouraging people to make a pledge. So if you will call in this morning and make a pledge at the $40 level or above, we will send you, with our thanks, a book, a new book. You can choose either fiction or nonfiction. And then I think we've set aside a special category of books discussed on Focus. It's kind of a grab bag. We can't give you your choice of title, but trust us, they're good books, and we think that you will enjoy them. So for a $40 contribution or more, if you can, we will send you, with our thanks, the book. 244-9455 is the number to call, and you will help us meet the challenge here from this couple in Urbana and the much larger challenge of keeping this radio station strong. Now, you know, I have a caller here that I want to get in. We don't generally take calls during the pledge breaks, but there's a caller here. It's on our line number one, would you like to identify yourself?
Yeah, hi, David. It's Jack.
Oh, my.
Oh, it's Jack.
I'm really enjoying the show. I'm sitting here back in my office doing some work and listening. And I wanted to tell
you. You know, I've been accused of phoning it in. But this is, you're taking it to a whole new level. This is literal. He's phoning it in, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, I just wanted to tell you that, you know how we talked about it takes a while for people to get the message that they need to make a call to make to the pledge line and make a contribution? Mm-hmm. Well, I just made a pledge.
No, wait a minute. No, I'm sorry. No, you work here. You've dedicated your life to public radio. You just now made a pledge?
I know. You know, what can I tell you? It took me this long.
Oh, God.
It really does take a while for people to get the message that you really got to support the station. And when we come on the air, we're doing these pledge drives, and especially when we've got a challenge going, we're giving away books to people who make the pledges. That, you know, it's an opportunity to take us up on that challenge. And for whatever reason, I just didn't get around to it before.
Oh, Jack.
But this morning I thought, you know what, I'm going to make the call. I got to do that. I mean, I'm telling other people to do it, right? So, you know, what kind of a hypocrite am I? So, anyway, I made a pledge, and actually I wanted to get the member card, so $75. And I'm getting a book, so that's even better.
All right. I can't really believe that you really have been a supporter of the station in the past, haven't you?
Oh, well, yeah.
Yeah.
We believe in being honest and upfront here. And
this was a reenactment.
Yes. Don't try this at home, professionals here at the station. It just shows you that we're trying every single goofy way that we could do. We'll do anything almost to get people to pledge. And if the shows
crazy, Dave and Jack.
Aren't good enough, well, a case in point.
The
show, we think that the programs speak for themselves. Sometimes I think, well, we really shouldn't have to sit here and remind you how good the programs are. If you didn't think the programs were good, you wouldn't listen to the radio station. Mm-hmm. You know that they're good. And Philip said earlier, I think that there are a lot of people who really depend on being able to go over to the radio and turn it on and have us there in the mornings and for focus and in the afternoons.
Without even thinking about it. It becomes the habit of your life.
You know, it's really true that a lot of the staff are also members of the station, contributing members. And like the Hair Club for Men, you know, I don't just work here. I'm a member. So we would encourage all of you listening, if you appreciate the show, and I know you do, please give us a call on the pledge line. Again, 217 is the area code, 244-9455. I'm putting my money where my mouth is, and I'm getting a book. So,
well, thank you very much. Thanks to others who have pledged. We want to get back here, talk to Philip and Tanya, do some more book talk. Before the end of the show, we will again check back because we definitely want to keep up, know where we are with the challenge, and we certainly want to make it. We want to get at least the 20 calls, and I think that we could easily do more. If you value the show and this station, if you're not a supporter, give us a call. Make a $40 contribution at the basic level, and we'll send you a book. And it'll mean a lot to us. This is Focus 580, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Oh, there was Jack signing off. And here with us on the program this morning, Tanya Leotsakis from Pages for All Ages Bookstore, and Philip Graham, who teaches English here at the U of I and is a writer. And every once in a while, they're here on the program. We talk about books. They bring things that they've been reading to recommend. And I always enjoy hearing about what they've been reading. And I have read many of the books that they have recommended and thought that they were very good. So I appreciate it. As Philip said, his question was, well, how do you find out about new books? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And one great way is for somebody else to say, hey, I read this thing.
Yeah.
This was
great.
Yeah. I think that you would like it too. We have someone to talk with in Chicago. Let's do that on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello. I wanted to recommend an old book, but I didn't hear the question about Medora Sales, but I've been able to get her books out from the public library if she wants to read rather than own, her police procedurals, which was The Murder in Focus. So if that's one way, if she just wants to read the books, she can get them through the library, and if her library doesn't have them, probably through interlibrary loan.
Sure.
Okay. And the book, I'm recommending an old book just because I thought it was so fantastic, and that's The Arms of Krupp by William Manchester. And especially if you need a book to read all summer, because it's pretty long.
He wrote long books.
It's the book to take, but it's amazingly well written when you think that it's sort of a dull subject in a lot of ways, but it brings in a lot of things such as how the arms race began and how it continued. And also, I think one thing that people forget about World War II and the Holocaust is how much individuals were responsible. And I think especially now as people justify the Abu Ghraib scandal and things like that, it's really interesting how the average German citizen was able to justify their involvement with the slave labor that was used by Krupp. And I think it's just one of those things that makes one of those type of books that makes you think. But most amazingly is that it really is well written.
Oh, very good. Good suggestion. And I'm sure that that book is still in print, or that you could, I'm sure also you could find it in the
library.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a big book. You might have to renew it one time.
Renew it several times. It really is a long book. That's why if you're going someplace and you want to take one book, if you have the weight, the luggage allowance, I would take that.
All right. Very good. Well, thank you. Well, other suggestions from people who are listening are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455.
I'm glad she said that about the library, because that's another good way to find out what to read. If you go into any bookstore or library, there are people there dying to accost you with their suggestions. I assure you. I mean, it's you should never be short of something to read, because librarians are – that's what they're there for. Yeah. That's what booksellers are there for.
Yeah, they love and they love books. They love to talk about them. Same thing for people in the bookstore. You don't think that you're bothering them.
No.
They love it.
That's the whole thing. We don't want to shelve books. We want to talk to people about what we've read.
There are no commercials on television for books, you know?
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
You know what I mean?
Isn't that interesting?
And so you have to ask booksellers and librarians
very few in magazines.
And friends. Yeah, you just don't see them. And the great, great awards, the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Critics Circle Award and the Penn Faulkner Award, well, three of those actually have ceremonies. They rarely get reported. They certainly don't get televised. Mm-hmm. And yet there are wonderful, wonderful books that are there. I was on a literary panel at a conference recently. One of the panelists just gave a list of 17 people that she thought everybody, you know, should read if they were thinking about, you know, world literature and so forth. And at the end of the list, she said, these were the last 17 Nobel Prize winners.
Wow.
And everybody was kind of stunned about, you know, because a lot of people, you know, were writing down names that they were hearing for the first time,
right,
or that they hadn't read the work by this person whose name they
had. And they said, my God, this guy won the Pulitzer.
Not the Pulitzer, I'm sorry, the Nobel Prize. Yeah, yeah. Which is supposedly the height of Mount Everest for a literary career.
Sure.
All right. Well, I think I'm next.
Okay. Again, how do you find a book? This book was sent to me in the mail, requesting me to write what's called an advanced comment or blurb for a book. You know,
those little things on the back of the book.
On the back of the book.
This is the greatest thing I ever read.
Since Swiss cheese or whatever. So I'm actually reading from an uncorrected page proof from a book that is listed as not coming out until June of 2005, but because this is May, it's probably already in the bookstores, because books always come out a month to 6 weeks before the publication date.
Not always.
Not always?
Oh, no. Sometimes, in fact, they postpone them. Oh, it's yeah. Well, but I mean, but yes, they frequently do. They frequently do come out beforehand. But
yeah. Well, I think you'll find this. If not, you can wait a tiny bit, just a tiny bit. I think it's called Gallery Bundu, with the subtitle "A Story About an African Past." It's a novel by an anthropologist named Paul Stoller, this is his second novel, and I like his work a lot. He's not a great stylist. That's certainly the case, but he captures in both his novels a real sense of what it's like living in Africa and the pace of Africa and the intimacy of relationships in Africa that I've never seen anybody quite capture as well. And this is a story about a young man. He's an older man. He's a man in his 50s, but thinking back to a time when he was young, a man named David, who he's the co-owner of a gallery that sells African art. And he thinks back through this novel to his time working in the Peace Corps in Africa and then deciding to stay in Africa and learn. And he apprentices himself to two different people, one an African man named Diop, who is himself a gallery owner of African art, who's teaching him just how to appraise and collect and understand African art. And then another man named Amadou, who's teaching him how to weave African textiles. And he apprentices himself to both these people. And I have just two brief sections from those two relationships here. It's David writing, I went with Diop to his chaotic household, which was hidden from the street by an 8-foot cement wall. Business profits had enabled him to construct 5 dwellings. Each of his wives lived in a 2-room rectangular mud brick house at the north end of the compound. Diop and his 2 older sons lived in a 4-room cement house in the center of the space. A mud brick cooking house, small and square, was adjacent to the rectangular house that Diop used to store art. Basins and pots and pans lay there and here and there among soapy puddles on the ground. Children dressed only in underwear played amid the puddles. Bits and pieces of African sculpture, tall, thin, fat, and sometimes horrific, peeked out from the compound's every nook and cranny. Diop showed me to the storage room, which doubled as a guest house. Although the room was dark and smelled of wood smoke, I immediately sensed the eyes of hundreds of statues and masks boring into my body. I then saw what was to be my bed, a canvas army cot on a narrow path among the objects. Ancestor figures had been stuffed under it. Above it, spirit masks hung from the wall and the ceiling. How can I ever sleep here? I asked my host. Laughter rippled through Diop's fleshy body. It's only wood, David. You'll sleep fine. That's easy for you to say. Maybe they'll drive away your bad dreams, Diop suggested. Maybe they'll let you sleep. He put his hand on my shoulder. You'll be fine here. Now, one of the problems of David is that when he was younger and a callow youth like Howard Norman earlier, he fell in love with and then abandoned an African lover who then he later learned, too late actually, to be able to do anything about it, who had a child by him. And he spends a great deal of his life trying to make amends for that and is really unsuccessful throughout a great bit of the book, but it's something that's actually tormented and tortured him for years. And this is a section where he's learning how to learning how to throw cowrie shells with his other mentor, Amadou, who's the person who's teaching him how to weave African textiles. That night, Amadou called me into his hut to throw cowrie shells. The inside of the hut glowed in the dull lantern light. The smell of kerosene permeated the air. Amadou sat on a straw mat close to the hut's center pole. A red fez covered his small-shaped head. He had wrapped a striped wood cotton blanket around his torso to protect his old bones from the chill of the night. "Sit, my son," he said. "It's time to prepare you for the future. We must see the paths ahead so that you'll be prepared." He opened his pouch of shells and dumped them on the smooth sand in front of him. He looked up at me. "Have you been throwing your shells, David?" "Not much, Baba," I replied. "When I throw them too much," I admitted, "I get headaches." "That's a good sign, my son. That's what happens when you throw the shells. It's the spirit Wambata. She's the one who gives you headaches." Quite frankly, I had trouble believing in Wambata, let alone her capacity to give me headaches. "I also have trouble reading my own future," I told him. "That's always the case," Amadou said. "It took me many years to read my own path. In time, you'll be able to do it. For now, you should practice on other people." "It's not so easy. People see a white man and doubt me." "You'll find a way, my son. That's how the shells work. Let them guide you." At that moment, I wondered if I'd ever understand Amadou's logic. His way of thinking was so alien. No instructions, no rules. I also had trouble with the idea of letting the shells take control of my destiny. When I had voiced these doubts in the past, Amadou had dismissed them with a warm laugh. Perhaps I was now ready to try Amadou's way and let the forces of the world work their magic. "Okay, Baba, I'll try to be patient and respectful." Amadou picked up 11 shells and cupped them in his open hands. He recited an incantation and spit on them. He looked at me, lowered his head toward the sand, and threw the shells. "Yes," he responded to an inaudible voice. "I agree. Yes." He again looked at me. "There are 2 paths that you will take. There's the path of cloth, which will bring you much joy and some renown. And then there's the path of wood. You know a man who has great knowledge. You will know him for many years to come. He's a big man with a pure heart. Listen to what he says. When he asks you to do something, make sure to do it. If you follow this man's path, you will find money." The reading impressed me greatly. Amadou had never met Diop, and I had never talked to him about the art trader. What's more, Amadou had zeroed in on Diop's defining characteristics. How could this be? I looked at the cowries lying on the sand and pondered my next question. "Can I find happiness through wood?" I asked.
Amadou threw the cowries again and examined the positions. It is clear that one day you will carry the burden of wood. You will talk about it to many people. You will buy it and sell it. It is not clear how wood will bring you happiness. It will comfort, but also trouble you. He pointed to several shells that formed a straight line in the sand. That, he said, is your other path, the path of cloth. Your weaving here in Tillaberry is only the beginning, my son. When you return to America, you will no longer weave, but you will find much cloth and keep it in your compound. It will not bring you money, and you will not buy or sell it, but you will talk a great deal about it, and your words will be filled with knowledge and wisdom. This, he said, wagging his finger at me at the line, will bring to you honor and respect. Amadou's reading flooded my mind with thoughts about the burdens of life. It was true that the statues in Diop's warehouse had comforted me. I even felt that they had expelled Zenobu from the world of my dreams, enabling me to sleep soundly. But would she return one day to haunt me? Besides, comfort did not equal happiness. I wanted more than comfort in my life. I needed love, but didn't know how or with whom I might find it. I knew one thing for certain. I would never be able to love a woman until I had resolved my relationship with Zenobu.
Tell us again.
Paul Stoller, S-T-O-L-L-E-R.
Has he written something else?
He's written a novel called Jaguar, which I've actually recommended on this program before, and this is his new novel, Gallery Bundu. Mm-hmm. And he's written several books of anthropology. Mm-hmm. He's a very good anthropologist.
According to my sources, this is supposed to be available officially June 1st.
Oh, okay.
It's the University of Chicago Press.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. We're coming pretty short here. We've got at least another 5 minutes.
Okay.
Tanya, you want to?
I will. I'm going to recommend In the Time of the Butterflies by Julia Alvarez. And I've read several books by her, and she's a great writer. Mm. This one is historical fiction about the Mirabal sisters. I don't know if you guys are familiar with them or not, but you can go to the website. And they are revolutionaries in the Dominican Republic. And they were like the first major like feminist revolutionaries that spoke out against Castro and that kind of thing and were involved in the revolution. They're four sisters. Mm. And it reads so nice like a novel, but you learn so much history from it. I mean, it's just because it's really true to life. And if you read any books about the Mirabal sisters at all, let's see. Minerva is probably the most famous one. Dede, Patria, and Mate, Maria Teresa. They call her Mate. Those are their real names. And they called them the butterflies. Mariposas, las mariposas. They called them the butterflies. It's a kind of a sad story, but, you know, it's true, and history is sad. The only one still living is the oldest sister, Dede, and I believe they've turned their house into a museum. It's Mirabal is how you spell their last name. They've turned their home into a museum now, and if you ever visit the Dominican Republic, you can go and learn all about their lives and the incredible sacrifices that they made. They were political prisoners for a long time, and this novel really lets you into their emotional lives. And they're four very, very different women. The oldest sister is now running that museum, and you can actually go and you can write to her, or you can speak with her and meet her and tell the whole thing. But they died in the revolution, her three sisters, but not before they made great advances and really powerful novel and beautifully written. Doesn't read like history at all, but when you finish it, you go, wow, I know a lot about Latin American history now. A lot, you know. Mm-hmm. So.
Very good. In the Time of the Butterflies by Julia Alvarez. Mm-hmm. And if you like her, that particular book, she has many
good books. Yes. Yeah.
You, I don't know, Philip, you want to go do one last one?
Want to read a poem?
Well, let's see if I can set it up properly. This is a book called 15 Poets of the Aztec World. How did I find out about this? By Miguel Leon Portilla, a graduate student who's entering our MFA program, mentioned that when he came here, he wanted to study Nahuatl, the
the language of the Aztecs, and I was looking up programs that we could find for him, so as a way of trying to get him into our program. And we got him into our program. He's going to be in here next year. I'm very happy about that. But he mentioned this book, 15 Poets of the Aztec World, and it's 15 poets, pre-Columbian poets, and essays about each one of these poets, too, because this is a really lost world. I mean, a lot of this world was burned and just destroyed.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is almost magical that you could have 15 poets who actually have histories and personalities and there are essays on them and so forth. One of them is a poet called Nezahualcóyotl, and he was a great king and a poet and a patron of the arts, and he's extraordinarily famous. He was a philosophical poet and so forth. I'm not going to read from him, though I was intending to. We don't have that much time. But I'm going to read from a guy named Kwakwatzin. And Kwakwatzin was a friend of Nahualcóyotl, and yet the worst thing that he ever did, that Nezahualcóyotl ever did, was steal away the fiancée of Kwakwatzin. He fell in love with her and arranged for Kwakwatzin to be sent to a very dangerous battleground where he would inevitably be killed.
And I think I've heard that story somewhere before.
Really? Yeah. Well, you know, it sounds like a Old Testament stories in some sense, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And Kwakwatzin understood the hidden motive that was going on here before he left. And yet, as it says here, faithful to his lord, he obeyed and set out for the war that was for him the same as marching to his death. But before he did that, he wrote some poems, knowing about what was going to happen to him. And this is one of those poems called The Sad Song of Kwakwatzin. My heart craves the flowers that they be in my hands. With songs I am sad. One of the also things very interesting here is in this poem he quotes the poetry of his king. You know, so there's a very ironic kind of twist to a lot of the language here. My heart craves the flowers that they be in my hands. With songs I am saddened. I only try to compose songs on the earth. I, Kwakwatzin, with anxiety I desire the flowers that they be in my hands, for I am dispossessed. Where would we go that we never have to die? Though I be precious stone, though I be gold, I will be dissolved, there in the crucible, melted down. I have only my life, I, Kwakwatzin, I am dispossessed. You make resound your kettle drum of jade, your red and blue conch shell. You, your Yonson, panting one, now he has come, for the singer has risen. For a short time be happy, come and be present, those with the sad heart. Now he has come, now the singer has risen. Open the corolla of your heart, let it tread the lofty heights. You have hated me. You have marked me for death. Now I go to his house. I will perish. Perhaps because of me you will weep. Because of me you will be sad, you, my friend. But now I will go. Now I am going to his house. Only this my heart tells. I will not return. Never will come back to the earth. Now I will go. I am going to his house. Only useless effort and joy, my friends. Should we not be happy? Should we not have pleasure, my friends? I will take with me the beautiful flowers, the beautiful songs. Never I do it in springtime. I alone am in need. Alone am I, Kwakwatzin. Should we not enjoy, my friends? I will take with me the beautiful flowers, the beautiful songs. Wonderful how at that moment where he actually addresses his betrayer who's sending him to his death in that poem.
And when was this written?
These were written, you know, centuries before Cortez came by.
What are the illustrations?
They're illustrations that are by Aztec artists,
right.
You know, illustrating in some cases, you know, the lives of the various poets or the histories about which the poets write. So the wonderful thing about this book is not only is the poetry very, very beautiful, very stately, but you, through the various biographies of each one of the poets, you learn about a world that has been deeply lost, that we know almost nothing about.
It's
a really profoundly interesting book. You know?
Very good. Well, go to our website. You will see the titles and the authors of the books that Phil Pantani have talked about this morning. And then if you're looking for something good to read, go to your favorite bookstore, go to the library, ask the people who worked there what they've been reading, yes. Ask your friends, and pass them around. That's the way we find out about new books.